And I was playing poker to pay my bills.
Seriously?
Seriously. And it was working out for a while. Then it, and then it wasn't. And so I busted out. I maxed out all my credit cards. Whoa. just kind of in a sickness about it, and ended up getting like this absurd job. I was like, I'm out of money.
Good day, and thanks for tuning into another episode of Matt Logan Music. I'm super stoked that you're listening, and I've got a good show for you today. My guest is Dan Carrigan. He is not a musician, but he is a creative person. He's an entrepreneur. He is a pedicab business tycoon. That's those cabs that are on bicycles, if you've ever hopped on one of those. He's in Austin and I think in the LA area, and right now he's doing some work in San Francisco. And he's also a stand-up comedian and an improv artist, and he's got some cool stories, and that's why he's on the show. We're going to talk about some of his experiences bombing in front of people, lessons learned while getting into kind of a creative business or going down a creative path, the parallels between that creative path and starting and running a business, and also just how good of a cup of coffee I can make. I bribed him to do this with coffee and an omelet, and you'll hear about that. So, oh, a quick heads up. If you got kids in the room, or you're listening to this with your kids, there's a little bit of swearing, but I mean, it's nothing. I mean, come on, we're all grown-ups, right? Nothing worse than what you hear in the office or at family reunions, or you know, in your own head. But I just did want to let you know, in case you got some kids in the room and you want to control for that. Okay, so we will talk a little bit about music, and I'll play a song for you at the end. It's features vocalist Anyan Lee. She's singing a song that I wrote, and it's called Solar Street Cred, and it's kind of nice, and I'll put that up in the show notes at mattloganmusic.com. So thanks again for dropping by, giving a listen, and if you are so inclined, leave a review, because that makes this more visible in iTunes, and that's rad. So enjoy this episode with Dan Carrigan. Okay, welcome to the Matt Logan Music Podcast. I'm here with Dan Carrigan.
Yeah, hey, what's going on? What's up, thanks, man, for having me.
And yeah, thanks for being here.
Thanks for making me amazing coffee.
You're welcome. I made you an omelet too.
Yeah,
must have been mediocre.
No, that was good, but the, you know, look, no, I'm not here coming in criticizing on the very first sentence of the podcast.
Save it for later in the podcast.
Right, yeah.
Makes sense. Now, that's part of my, we were talking about this earlier, that's going to be my ploy, I think, now to get people in to talk with me.
Yeah, it's a slow burn to the insult of your omelet.
Yeah. If I can get people to buy into a cup of coffee, they'll probably say okay to the podcast.
You should just start a coffee shop where you podcast with the people that come in.
That's like an idea.
Yeah, like that's 2-3 minutes. You should start another podcast. Forget this trash test podcast. Just okay, brand new.
So last episode was the inaugural one. This is our
final.
I'd like to thank everybody for sticking with me over the years.
Yeah, you know, you really let it catch on.
Yeah, it was good. So this is the Matt Logan Music Podcast, but here's the thing. I'm multidimensional, you're multidimensional listeners, and Dan is multidimensional, so we don't just have to talk about music, and we're going to talk about a few different things today, so I guess just deal with it.
Yeah.
Right?
Just take this job and shove it.
Hey, that's musical. Perfect, perfect. If we can just bring in as many, who was that, Johnny Paycheck? If we can, was that him? Does anybody know? Take this job and shove it. I don't work here anymore. And I think it was paycheck. I don't know. I'll look that up. But Dan is an entrepreneur, a comedian, a cool dude, and the reason I asked him to come on the show is just I think he's got an interesting story and life situation, and I want to hear about his creative process. But before we get too much into that, I guess I'll just ask you, Dan, what's up with you?
What's up with me? Well, shoot, I've just spent a lot of time bouncing around the country. I don't know, where should I start? The very beginning?
The very beginning.
In 2005, I was finishing my language requirement at Boston College, and because I had not made it to the SAT 2s to qualify out of it.
Okay.
So a couple of times I paid the SAT Standard Scholastic Aptitude Testing Corporation,
right,
like $80 to pay to take the SAT 2s and to place out of my language requirement, because in high school I had taken University French, and I'm like, cool, I don't need to take this in college, I don't need to take this, and you know, like just right, like placing out AP classes and whatever, right? And so that credit did not transfer, so I needed to place out by taking the SAT 2s. But I had never made it to either of the two times I was supposed, like, I got down there and the lady's like, it's too late. And I'm like, no, it's not too late. I can fill out these bubbles faster than anybody. I'll put my name on the, they're like, no, we can't let you in. Well, I blame parking in Boston, but yeah, it was really me being late. And so I was in my super senior semester, taking one class that I was seriously just trying to get a C out of.
Right.
Right.
French.
And, yeah. French. Okay. And my teacher knew it.
Right.
Just like
right,
show up maybe half the time, like complete the homework, whatever. And I was playing poker to pay my bills.
Seriously.
Seriously. And it was working out for a while, then it, and then it wasn't. And so I busted out. I maxed out all my credit cards, just kind of in a sickness about it, and ended up getting like this absurd job. I was like, I'm out of money. I gotta come clean. I gotta tell my parents I fucked up. I don't know how I'm gonna pay rent.
Right.
I gotta go get a job like now. And so I had some friends who were working at this really random place. Great friends who are doing awesome now. And it's called Five Wits Tomb, right? And Five Wits was the company, and it's like a reference to Shakespeare.
Okay.
And Tomb was this. They kind of have something like it, like you go into a room and you try and figure out the puzzle before the room like explodes or something. It's like a team building sort of exercise.
Sure, sure.
So this was an interactive adventure through an Egyptian tomb.
Whoa.
And there were like four or five of us that would work there and be the tour guides who would also do all the rest of the duties of running a business.
You're facilitators.
Yeah.
And you had, okay, so you
also. So, like, somebody's at the register, and then, you know, you cycle out, and somebody, okay, it's your turn to go in the tomb.
Right, right.
And you learn the little script they have, and I never liked to stay exactly on script because I thought it was pretty silly.
Right.
And so I would play with it a lot, and they already didn't like that. And we got to go through the tomb, and it's really cool. Actually really cool to go through like twice.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, sure. I figured it out. I've seen all the things that can happen. And now I just am being a snarky jerk.
Right.
In this tomb to these people who want a good experience. I didn't really care. It was just like, it's $8 an hour. Just get me through a fucking day.
Right. Right.
Can I curse? Is it okay to curse?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh God. Thank you.
Yeah.
and after a while they're a fledgling business, and they need some more publicity, so they print up a bunch of flyers, and they say, hey, there's Red Sox games. We want you to go flyer out at the Red Sox games.
Okay.
I said, okay. Is paying the same? He said, yes. He said, put me on all of those shifts. Just keep me out of the fucking tomb.
Right.
And so I go over to Fenway, and I'm handing out flyers, and the very first day I'm doing this, and I'm just so happy to be outside.
Uh-huh.
So happy to be away from the team. Around baseball, I was, I guess I was a Red Sox fan at that point. The change happened. Yeah, the change happened.
The change from
the Mets fan. Okay. I mean, like, I still like the Mets, but right. Caught the fever, like, 2002, 2003. So that makes me sound like a real weak person, you know, just like bandwagon fan.
Yeah.
As I continue to wear my Red Sox hat.
Loyal guy here.
Yeah. Loyal guy. Until you give all your money to Bernie Madoff.
Right.
yeah, poor Mets. So I'm out flyering, and I see a guy drive up on a pedicab. I said, oh, my God, I could totally do that. I didn't know that's here.
Uh-huh.
And I talk to the guy, and I'm like, hey, how do I get this job? And he says, just come in for an interview. I said, cool. I ran the marathon last year. I used to do something similar in New York City. I'm all about this. And he's like, come on in. So I got the job. Suddenly, I'm doing this thing, and we're working Red Sox games, and we're going $5 to Fenway, just like lining up in an area that is not very far from the park.
Mm-hmm.
And I start devising alternate strategies for picking up rides. And finally, one guy tells me, who I take a ride with, we take a pretty long ride to Chinatown in Boston. He goes, you know, we would have made a lot more money on that ride if you had just said tips only, like pay whatever you want. I said,
right.
Really? It's like, yeah, we would have easily gotten at least $20. We got it. Which is, now, if I think about that ride from Fenway to Chinatown, I wouldn't do it for less than 30. Now that I know what the value of the thing was, but it was my first year doing it. I said, okay, I'm going to try that. So I started trying that. And then we were on an honor system, reporting what we made and paying a percentage up to a point, our cap.
I see.
So I...
Wait, at the cap, they keep the rest of it, or you keep the rest?
I keep the rest of it. Okay. So, like, I'll pay 40% up to $400, and after that,
is
mine.
That.
So,
nice. Okay.
In a little place I like to call Cap Country. You know? Like, I'm in Cap Country, baby. All these rides are mine.
Yep.
You know? And so I start just destroying people on numbers for the next couple of weeks. And the guy, the boss, calls me in. He goes, how are you making so much money? I'm like, well, here, X, Y, and Z, man. I'm just, like, thinking about other things that are going to work besides $5 to Fenway, which is absurd.
Right.
Because you can't come up with $70 in a day of $5 to Fenway unless people are throwing stupid tips on top. So he says, all right, we're going to try tips for just 1 week, and then we'll talk about it. And I never heard from him about it again, because that became the thing that they do to this very day.
Oh, wow.
So suddenly I'm making a lot of money straight out of college on a tricycle. Like, and a lot. I mean, bartender money. Like, good bartender money, right?
Yeah.
And I found that I was very, very good at it because I have a natural knack for talking to people. I love talking to people. I'm also somebody who had been doing stand-up and trained in theater. So it became a script that I had.
Sure.
Every ride I would, you know, and to this day, because I still love to do this, even though now I own my own shops, but the joy of it is getting somebody else to do the management so I can still be just a rider.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, because that's the most fun. It's like you're exercising and bullshitting with people.
Right.
So the framework of the script is like, you know, you pitch the ride, you have a successful pitch, somebody gets in, you introduce yourself, You start showing them what the pedicab can do, because when you get in it, it's like a ride,
right?
And
yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
You now have control over people's bodies.
Uh-huh.
And you're just like, ha-ha, check that out. Like, wah!
So you give them a little thrill.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And like, and you know, you can open with a number of things like, hey, where are you from? You know,
sure.
First game of the year, whatever conversational opener. So conversational opener after intro, sometimes I'll just do that thing and they'll say something and we'll talk about that. And then, or you just, some people aren't in the mood to talk and you just kind of eavesdrop because they like literally are as far away from my backside as you are from me right now.
Right. You can't not hear.
Yeah. And it's like, drop. Even if they're whispering, which there's great stories about things that I've heard whispered. I was just like, I don't want you to get blown in the back of this cab.
Like, imagine that.
Yeah. And it was like, this is about to be a very expensive ride, guys. Because I don't like that. That is my only blanket.
Yikes.
Yeah. So it turned into this scripted thing. And every time I would finish a ride, I would come back and I would say, what did I do wrong on that ride? How can I improve that ride? It was very much also a sales education in, you know, how do I close this ride when I'm receiving the money? Since it's a tips situation, how do I frame it so that I get what I want? What strategies are working best for me? And so it was a creative process in that. And also you start to find jokes that always work, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I feel, we're going uphill. I feel so bad. I said, don't worry. I love this shit. You know, like, what do you do when you get fat people? This is my Massachusetts passengers.
Right, right.
Like, I just go slower, you know? Is this hard? I said, no, it's not hard. I mean, do you want to make it harder? Like, start jumping up and down or, like, I don't
know. Right, right.
Just the things that always come up.
Well, you could test. Well, yeah, certainly you had the comments that would always come up, and then you could constantly be testing both in your sales delivery and also this other part of you, which has a love for improv and comedy.
Yeah.
So I can see how, at first, I thought that these were kind of disjointed, like, passions, but really
no they're so there's such a confluence of ability for both of those things. So
right.
my desire and love for improv fits very well into the pitching rides part of this, and also my experiences with improv make conversations easier because I can just build something off of what somebody else is saying that might be factual because I'm speaking from experience, or abstract because I'm taking something they said and running with a fabricated circumstance.
Right, right.
That now we're kind of riffing on a thing that they didn't realize. Now we're joking.
Uh-huh.
You know, and it kind of gives you a lot of control in conversation.
Sure.
Especially when you're also in control of their actual destination, like their transportation.
They're putting a lot of trust in you.
Yeah.
And you're doing two things. I'm just to make sure we're still recording. Good. So I'm thinking of, like, neurologically what's happening when you give them that first little thrill, you know, there's that kind of reward payoff. And then if you get them laughing too, that's another, you know, probably like a dopamine dump or in their brains.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of cool things.
What
going
I like
on.
To call that extra five. It's
exactly.
Like, you know, and the improv helps so much when you're pitching the ride because it just pays off to be ridiculous and get people to pay attention. Now, it's different regionally.
Sure.
Because when I started, we're in Boston, and if you don't hustle and, like, pitch rides, it's just not going to be as good for you. You have to break people in Boston. They have this facade up, this cold demeanor. And as soon as you can make them laugh for a second, now you have access to them for a moment and say, come on, we're going to have fun. Let's take a ride.
Yeah, I've heard that's a hard town to do comedy, or I would imagine it is, especially if you're a newcomer. What's your experience?
Every town's a hard town to do comedy if you're not willing to work hard enough to do comedy.
I see.
So, okay. I mean, it's got a good scene, and, uh-huh. you know, it's got people that are that way.
Right.
You know, just tough people or tough-sounding people. But Boston hearts melt easy, man. They're good people. They just have that thing. It's like, no, fuck you. I'm not going out there. I don't want to do this.
Right.
No, you do it.
It's kind of gritty, kind of.
Fine, I'm going. But just because you said please. You know? Like, that's...
Right.
It's just
right.
like, you know, if you're polite.
You have to resist first. And then...
Yeah. It's like... When I go from Austin, Texas, people there are very friendly, mm-hmm. very willing to converse.
Right.
Like, I've had more conversations with strangers at gas stations in Texas than I have any other place in the world.
Seriously?
Yeah. And they'll just be like, nice day today. Like, yep. Like, I just came back from Boston. I'm like, yeah, great. The weather. Yeah. It's like... Got a good-looking truck there, my friend. Thank you. Thank you very much. I like your...
Nice boots.
No, you got a real sturdy vehicle there yourself, sir. But, you know, you kind of fall back into it. But it's just like when you're talking about accessing people and pitching rides, it's just so much different in Texas.
I can imagine.
Yeah, people are willing, like, the amount of no thanks I get in Texas. Yeah.
No, thank you.
And, I mean, just so many pedicabs in Austin. It takes a special set of people to be that patient to say no thank you probably 30 times as you walk through the city.
Right.
And in Boston, like, shut you out. They will ignore you.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's kind of
it's gonna be weird.
It's great because you know traveling as much as I do, I'm just like, oh man, could you just fucking say no, thank you. Is that too much to ask? Just acknowledge me. I'm here.
Did you ever say that?
Of course, because it gets people to turn around and look and engage you.
Right.
Hey, no thanks.
Do you think it has anything to do with the weather? Like, it's just so cold in Boston. You know. But then again, you know, being from Iowa, and you said your dad's from Wisconsin, it's cold there too.
Yeah.
But people aren't jerks.
No.
You know?
People are extremely friendly in Green Bay.
Like, right.
And I've worked there too, and they're just so glad that we're around. Just like, take me to the bar. And I'm like, okay, you got it.
Right.
Oh, and I'm glad I'm not walking now, you know? But I don't think it's the cold. I think it's just the mentality of the region, you know, because the cold is pervasive to the northern part of the country, right?
Yeah.
People in Seattle are different than people in Wisconsin, are even different from people in Minnesota, than you know New York or Boston or maniacs, Mainers. Because when it warms up, like, even getting into the winter in Boston, people are still okay until, like, mid-January, late January. And they're like, it's going to be this way for a while. And they get crusty and angry. And then it's March and that final snowstorm comes through in April.
Right.
And they're just like, is it ever going to fucking get better? It's like now suddenly it's May and you had like one of those Mays that it just rained every day and it's gray and the Sox still haven't gotten their shit together.
Right, people
are just like, I fucking can't take it anymore here. Like, I'm moving out to the West Coast. It's like, that's what I did.
But then summer comes around and it's,
people are great people again,
friendly
and helpful, and as much as they can be with the directions that are miserable to give in Boston.
Well, what is it? What do they have there for the public? Is it the tea?
The tea.
Yeah.
So good.
Man.
It's actually pretty. I'm not gonna get down on the tea, except that it doesn't run late enough. That's the only problem.
Same with BART. It's like
it's absurd.
I
the taxi lobby and its death grip.
What's up? Although they say here there's something to do with the maintenance with the BART, so it can't run past like 1230.
Bullshit.
But I know, right? I've seen it. They
Bullshit.
Can figure it out.
Yeah.
Man, but this thing was built in like, what, 1970? BART is old. It's old. And somehow, I heard...
Well, the T is older.
Like, oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, somebody yeah. sneezes on the red line, it shuts down.
Shuts down?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
It's terrible because it's cold and flu season.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's disgusting. Man, oh, it's disgusting. So are you actively doing comedy right now?
I am. So this whole journey of pedicabbing led me to start my own pedicab company in Austin.
Okay.
When I realized I was only living on a dream in L.A., for the few months that I first lived there,
okay,
I moved out to do comedy, and it was take one. I'm like,
right.
I don't have my shit together. I got to go get something started. So I moved back to Austin, and I started up my company, and it was a place that, aside from starting the company, I did have. Austin's magical because even I don't know if it's the same, but if you live out in the outskirts where it's still affordable, the cost of living is a little bit less,
right?
And it affords you all of this time because you don't need too much to get by if you've got your situation right in Austin.
Right, right.
I mean, it's changing now. It's got a lot of tech coming in, and the rent has gone sky high for Austin. But at the time that I was living there, you know, the first place I was living, it was paying like $300 a month to $350 for a room in a 4-bedroom house, like have a couple roommates, fine.
Yeah.
Totally good situation for, you know, three of us paying $350 each. It's like, holy shit. I mean, I could see hookers from my front doorstep, but that was like, whatever. They were,
whatever.
They're nice people.
Yeah.
They're just, that's what they do.
Right.
You know, like, just don't come knocking on my door. I don't need a hooker, right? It's like, what, you asked once, right? That's it. Like, maybe mow my lawn instead.
They need to go through your training program for the, they need to break you down.
Yeah, yeah.
The right opener.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And maybe I'd be more interested in hookers if they could just get my attention better.
Hey, you. Oh, man.
Yeah, so when I got back there, I said, oh, I've got all this time to actually, you know, create and do improv. And so I got more involved in the scene there, and I was doing stand-up there, and got involved doing sketch comedy, which I love, I think is my favorite. And we did a project called The Velvet Rut, which was about lifestyles people get into that they get stuck in. Because many people call Austin the Velvet Rut or the Velvet Coffin, where, like, service industry goes to die.
Oh, okay.
Because it's such a comfortable place just get by and be good with that, right? And, like, musicians will go to Austin and just never make it out.
Right, right.
Because it's so easy to get by, and you're it's just, you know, comfortably numb.
Sure.
Like, to your dreams.
Another song reference.
Yeah, letting... letting them kind of be satiated in the way that is you being in a small pond full of people that appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
So, like, as far as stand-up goes, the scene in Austin is fantastic.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's full of great comedians who are supportive, most of all.
Uh-huh.
And so for a comic like myself that was not very good at stand-up, when I was doing it there, I had some of the most supportive and best crowds. And it's like, nice. It's the easiest place to test jokes.
Right.
Which gave me being a stand-up is often about insecurity, a false sense of security about my material, such that when I went to LA and started doing it there, I was getting my ass handed to me in silence.
Seriously? You know? Oh, man.
Yeah. So open mics, like, I just second guess all your material and just scrap everything and throw it the fuck out.
Right.
And it's like, is this what I'm doing with my life? Like, the paralyzing self-doubt.
Oh, that's gotta be horrible. What's the worst room you've ever done? Worst experience?
I think the worst experience I had, there were two that I would say were equally bad. One was the second time I had ever done stand-up.
Okay.
Because the first night I had ever done it, I grew up with George Carlin as a hero. The set that I had done was very language playful, like he has done in many times.
Sure.
It's like just taking expressions and like picking them apart, and I was very well rehearsed for that first go. My grandparents were there. My mom was there. A couple of my college friends were there.
Yeah, yeah.
And said, I'm just trying stand up. This is the first time. So, okay, we're coming. It was awesome. And I had a really great set.
Yeah.
Like, it went well.
And this was in Boston.
This was in New York.
This was in
New York City.
Okay.
Being from New York and going to school in Boston, my New York Boston friends,
I see, yeah,
who were from New York as well, come out to the show, and so it went really well. We all celebrated. I was like, "Wow,
I'm
awesome! I can do comedy. You know, that's so cool." And the very next night, I had booked back to back clubs.
Uh-huh.
I did Gotham Comedy Club. The first one was New York Comedy Club. And I did Gotham Comedy Club. My mom came again, my best friend, and my dad came. My dad secretly knows I'm funny. He does. But he saw probably the worst stand-up I've ever done. The room was... God, the first thing I did was funny, and then the rest of the things I did were just complete aberrations from the things I had done the night before. I did classic beginner's mistakes of, oh, I got to change my set, or I wasn't comfortable improvising with my stand-up, or riffing on myself, or there have been sets where I'll just like, I'm like, this isn't going well. I'm just going to tear into myself right now. And that has turned sets around to the point where people are like, wow, well, at least he's listening to the room, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was embarrassing. Like, that was the first time I felt embarrassed for a bad set.
Man.
And it was like, 'cause my dad was there. It was just like, I just want to like be like, hey, I'm doing this. I did it great last night. Check it out tonight. And
even if
he doesn't think it's that funny, you know, it's like, the reaction of everybody else will gain his approval, right? So,
I see what this is about.
Yeah, well, no, yeah, right? Isn't it about
it
those things?
Is.
Yeah.
I've felt the same way when my dad's come to hear my bands play, because he's a musician, right? And so it's, and I'm sure, I mean, his dad's a musician, and I'm sure he's felt that way when his dad has come to hear his bands. You know, it's always been new music.
Yeah.
You know, my great grandfather, or no, not my great, my grandfather played in, you know, swing bands and jazz bands, and he wrote like for concert bands and stuff. And then my dad was playing like soul and like pop and kind of rock music, but not like, like psychedelic rock. It was more like top 40 rock stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was playing whatever I was playing. And so it's always uncomfortable performing in front of your dad.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, For most of us, our parents are extremely important people in our lives that whose validation you always are seeking.
Right.
Even though it often comes unconditionally.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I want, since I'm a very different person from my father in a lot of ways, I wanted him to see, like, hey, you know, I'm studying theater, I'm doing comedy, I want you to see that I'm working at it and I'm being good at it.
Right, right.
Instead of tanking my second set ever.
Oh, man.
In front of you. And then the...
What did he say?
Not much.
Not much.
He just... Yeah. I mean, it came in very... precise jabs later, like weeks and months later, years later, he'll make jabs like, well, is it anything like your comedy? And it's just like, Jesus Christ, Dad. And it's funny now because I can take a joke.
Oh my God.
But, and the other bad experience was, I think it was, I can't remember the name of the club. It's on Sunset, in LA. The Laugh Factory, And it was their open mic. And so, I would usually go to open mics where I know one or two people, right? Or at least it's just kind of one of those mics where, it's in a dive bar and it's like, we found a space that's good enough and, you know, let's get this together. And it's not like it's bad comedians, it's good comedians practicing the craft and doing kind of alternative comedy.
Right.
Mostly, like, not finding that mainstream sort of situation.
It's not like the big HBO special.
Yeah, well, you know, and these people, I think the culture of the comedy scene has shifted a little bit where that is a little more mainstream now because we've got shows like Tim and Eric, got shows where John Benjamin has a van and you're just like, what the hell kind of jokes are these, you know? You know, stand-ups who do atypical stuff are more in the mainstream now. So when I go into a comedy club on their open mic night and there's, you know, people from bumfuck Arkansas wandering into this big old comedy club. And not that Arkansans are bad people. They're good people.
Right.
It's just like they're having this this L.A. experience. And I'm doing material that just doesn't play in a comedy club like that. And also feeling like just an overwhelming amount of anxiety about doing it, even though I feel comfortable on stage. I don't have a problem bombing because I've done it so many times. And, you know, these people just don't get it. And then a string of other comedians come up who seem to have a real handle on a small room with, like, it's just such a daunting setup. You got the stage, you've got maybe like 10 or 15 people in here on an open mic night for this place. And then you've got 25 comedians in the back left corner out of the way of the rest of the room that is supposed to be reserved for actual guests.
Right.
Right. So the comedians are relegated to this waiting area, which is, I don't know, it's not really that bad, but it's just this like vicious little cadre of people just going like, I just fucking, it's bad.
Right.
Like just whispering about what comedian is up there or what they're doing. And then this one guy, just goes up and crushes it with no material. He's just like trashing other comedians and bullshit and calling on the audience. And it was just great crowd control. And I was just like, before or after, like his good set made me feel terrible about my set. That was, I don't know, watchable. There to be viewed.
Right.
Yeah.
Man,
so
comedy is such an interesting art form to me because, I mean, it's weird for one thing. Mm-hmm. Like, all right, make me laugh. You have to really be funny. You can be funny around your friends, but it's different. It's a completely different thing, you know, and. It's you're just so exposed, and like you said, you were okay with bombing, and you have to get to that point. Most of us take ourselves so seriously that bombing is like the worst thing that could possibly happen.
Yeah,
you know, or feeling like you're not part of the group when you do bomb. How do you become okay with that?
Well, part of it can be expecting it to be the norm.
When lower your expectations.
I don't know what this says about me, besides maybe it makes me more of an improv guy than a stand-up guy.
I think you're a stand-up guy.
Well, hey, thanks. That's okay. Sweet of you. sorry. Yeah, you know, you never want to get the rim shot.
No.
So, in stand-up, when I was doing it in Austin, I would I'd be very lazy about it because I feel as much as people work on stand-up, I also felt like there is a format or a form of stand-up where you can know the few ideas you want to talk about and be able to improvise upon them. Or at least I felt that way at the time. So that's how I was approaching a lot of my sets. Say, I've got bam, 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 bam. I know these three things that I want to talk about and riff on.
Right.
Which is something that maybe if I were dedicated to it and did it like 5 times a week, it would get better. and it's not like I had no success because I kept doing it.
Right.
And there were some sets that turned out wildly funny. And it was just like, wow, for those 6 minutes, I was on fire and I had the right conversation with the audience. And I found what they thought was funny that night, and I could improvise upon that and move in that direction. Because it is a conversation with the audience, right. You know, even in music, you know, mm-hmm. if you're like on a riff or something and you start leaning into that thing that, you know, you're feeling, because if you're feeling it, then
yeah.
Maybe they are too.
Right.
And you're just trusting your sensibilities.
Exactly. And you see it too.
Yeah.
You see it. And you can feel it. You can feel that conversation, that dialogue that's, well, I guess in comedy it's verbal, but,
mm-hmm.
But you're the only one talking, man. I guess what you're reading when you're a comedian is people's body language and mm-hmm. whether or not they're laughing.
But, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so as I was approaching those sets like that, I felt like there's a place where you can do that. So you can improvise most of the stand-up. But the best way to do it is to actually write it and to write, rehearse, riff, revise,
right.
Rehearse and grow it. And it is, I'm an impatient person. So I started seeing that as like, no, I bet there's a better way. That's a lot of work.
Right, right.
And I'm thinking about how much work I put into that first set. Well, yeah, there was some success, and because it was well rehearsed, and because I couldn't be shaken from what I knew,
right.
What I thought was going. And you know, the answer's there. It's like, oh, that worked on my first time.
Right, right.
And then on my second time, I tried to change things, and it died. Yeah. So, but there are people who can do that improvisational feel to uh-huh. just like, here's an idea. Like Dave Chappelle can go out there and right, just right. talk to the audience and just pull an observation out of thin air and take it down a very twisted road that somehow a conversation with some lady in the third row of the theater is getting just fiercely political or satirical.
Right, right.
And it just comes out of nowhere. And it's like, how did you, where's that ability?
Right.
You know,
right.
can you make that?
Well, it sounds like, I mean, so just like you kind of found a hack with your pedicab business and how you're getting more out of it. It sounds like you're looking for that in comedy too. Like, how can you extract more with less?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just, yeah. I, well, it comes down to a pretty philosophical fundamental for me, where we only have the amount of hours in our lives that we're given. And it's like searching for the fountain of youth, right? You can only dedicate so much time to certain things, and the more you get bogged down in, oh my God, I'm starting a pedicab business, and like it became, in a way, a distraction to all of my creative pursuits. Where, okay, I've given myself this job, which is great, because now I'm in a better financial position than I were to be if I was, you know, bar backing or something.
Right.
A terrible bartender. but it also comes at a cost. So, and it's a lot of time, and it's a lot of unsatisfied creative pursuits that, you know, now I feel like are exploding to get out of me.
Yeah. Well, now you've got your financial situation covered. You're like, okay, it's that next level of
right. But at the same time, you know, I've got contemporaries and who have done so much in that same amount of time and have just, you know, have just gotten by.
Oh yeah.
And I don't know what's better. You know, like, they have a body of work and they have a reputation now.
Right.
And now I'm coming back in at entry level, knowing a couple of people who are doing well. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, I just got to fucking go to work, man. That's all. Right. That's the difference. You know, they did the work. I did some different work. Uh-huh. So I'm driven now.
Yeah.
You know, by that.
Sure.
So it's very cool to see. I'm very excited that success is accessible.
Right.
You know, and it's being proven to me by people that I have joked around with often. You know?
So it's there. It's real.
Yeah, it is real. Like, it's not a pipe dream.
Isn't it weird how we often look at our creative pursuits and or our creative inclinations and think, like, doing that for a living, I mean, it's just so, it's so far out that it's so unreachable. But yet we tackle something that we make a job, like starting a pedicab business. Like, that's not an easy thing to do. You're in multiple cities. Like, it's a hustle, you know, and it's probably taking hours and hours of work, but we something about just that creative side, we're kind of scared of it. Mm-hmm. And kind of, I think some of it is also what we think other people are gonna think of us if we say, hey, I'm gonna be a professional comic,
you know? Yeah,
I'm gonna be a professional musician. Like, it totally changes the game.
Yeah,
right? It totally changes the game.
Yeah.
And it's kind of scary.
It's extremely scary. It's the hardest part is actually doing it. I mean, you know, backing up the talk.
Right.
You know, because if you're not wholeheartedly doing it, then it kind of shows, and it's going to give you the results that you would expect of that.
Right.
Except you may delude yourself and expect different things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a little terrifying, even coming from the place where I am, where, you know, now it looks like I'm going to have a pretty, like, a wealth of time to pursue things. It's just like, oh my God, am I really, like, is this what I'm all about now? Mm-hmm. Like, now I've got a new, like, it's like changing jobs and your whole world of responsibilities.
Yeah.
Flips.
Man, I know. I left my job over at the hospital in July, and it's still taken me a little bit to shift perspectives and, like, who I am and what I do now, and, like, kind of taking that on and really being comfortable and, like, settling into it. Mm-hmm. It is, it, it, it was weird because all of a sudden here's all this time.
Yeah.
You know, what am I?
Well, and how old are you now?
I'm 29.
29? So, yeah. Like, you're at the point where you start to see the curtains have dropped a little bit and you're like, ah, I see how it works. Uh-huh. I'm not just chasing a dream. I'm chasing a strategy.
Right.
You know? Exactly. And I see the path.
Uh-huh.
And now I know how to navigate it adequately or you know, the proper tactics to take. Uh-huh. So yes, exactly. First coming out to LA, I was like, yeah, I don't know, do that. Like, you know, like, I don't know what I was thinking. Just like take class and kind of pick up this and that and uh-huh. start doing work. But now I see, as social media and everything has also grown as this is a part of your business of you mm-hmm, mm-hmm, as a yeah. comedian or a musician, you need to full-time market yourself.
Right.
And you need to be dedicated to all of the emails you must send to all of the people that need to be aware that you are somebody that exists and right, doing right. the work that they're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is almost as big of a distraction to doing the creative side of things.
Right. Right.
Than it is as an entirely different job.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's also a weird position where you have to, when you have to start promoting yourself and your business. Like mm-hmm. I really struggled with that. When I first kind of started going down this road, it's like, well, I'm going to have to put my shit out there. You know,
yeah.
I know that I've got something valuable to offer, but I yet to communicate it. And that's kind of a weird hat to wear, especially when you're a creative and you just want to create and put your stuff out there
yeah.
and hope people flock to it. But that's not yeah. how it works. It's just not, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the thing that I'm grateful for about the business is, you know, I may not be the best business owner in the world. And that is an understatement because I'm definitely not. but I feel like I've done pretty well with what I have. And I uh-huh. like to treat the people that work for me well because that keeps them wanting to work for me, right? Like
right,
it's
right.
the positive strategy versus, you know, just yeah. give you the bare minimum and hope it's cheap enough.
Right.
Right. And knowing that what it takes to operate at that level and to market the businesses on a separate level and seeing all of the professionalism required of running a business is something that I didn't know was going to be not just useful, but necessary
right, right.
to advance. Uh-huh. I was thinking just recently about the people that work on Saturday Night Live, and they are under tremendous pressure every week to come up with sketches to put themselves through the ringer of the schedule that mm-hmm. they have accepted as part of their lives, as I have the honor of being on a show like Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Whatever you think of the current season or, you know, whatever. Yeah, yeah. But like you're taking up a standard.
Right.
And you're going through that schedule and I said, man, you've got to work really hard to get there. And the people that get there don't even always progress.
Right, right.
It takes a different kind of animal than I thought I was at the time.
Right.
But you have to be willing to learn and you have to be willing to change.
Sure.
If you're gonna really go for it.
Right. And then so just bringing another to draw another parallel with your business, like learning the business and learning the hustle, I'd like you had to learn that. And now that will apply to,
right.
to whatever you do. Like, you know how it works now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, every experience has value.
Right. Right. Man. So we probably got to wrap this up pretty soon. Awesome conversation. I've got a couple quick questions
sure.
for you.
Well, I refuse to answer them now that we've come this
far. All right.
Far.
Well, that's it, everybody. We will.
No, shoot. We'll let's go.
Favorite band right now or something you listened to recently?
Big Grams.
Big Grams. Killer.
Dude.
Killer.
That song Goldmine Junkie is on repeat in my head right now as we're speaking. Nice. It's so good.
So for people who don't know, that's Fantagram and
Big Boy
from Outkast.
Yeah.
Yeah. So killer. They played at Treasure Island this year.
Oh, really?
And I didn't get to make it. That's a music festival in the Bay Area, the island in between Oakland and San Francisco.
Yeah.
It's called Treasure Island. Man, I wanted to be there.
Yeah, you know, that I like Fantagram some, and I love Outkast.
Right.
And I just like that sort of ambient, but ambient music with a beat, you know, like just good driving beat. And I think it's just such a good collaboration between, you know, the producing abilities of what comes with Big Boy and Fantagram's just incredible voice.
Yeah, yeah. And their sonic palette, just all the different
things
that they can pull from. Yeah, I just saw Fantagram a couple weeks ago. They were opening up for Muse. Muse was so loud and I couldn't stay.
No?
It was so loud.
You know, I've seen them
I'm getting old.
Separately, and Fantagram at Electric Forest this summer.
Nice.
Which is a place I was pedicabbing, but we also had free reign to go into the festival. So it's an amazing place to be. Like just hammocks everywhere.
Yeah,
just think of your heaven made of hammocks
and
everybody's on drugs also. that's
place.
But I checked out Fantagram there and they were great. And it was like really the only band I wanted to see because, you know, I don't want to see a 4-hour String Cheese Incident set. I'll listen to a couple songs, but that's quite all
right.
And then, I saw Muse at ACL like 5 years ago. And that was, I don't know, maybe it was how drunk I was, but it was kind of a religious experience.
Was
I'm not even a huge Muse fan, but they were very, very good.
They put on a huge show.
Yeah. The light
it's
show was
massive.
Incredible.
Yeah. 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 And I will say that like a buddy of mine works at Oracle Arena, which is where the show was. And he kind of manages the non-sports events. So, he's the director. He's very fancy, and he gets me into these shows, which is killer.
Yeah.
It's awesome. But he was talking just about the setup, the rig. Like, they had to have engineers come in and, like, test the ceiling to make sure. They had 4 or 8 people up above the stage for the entire time, which isn't that unusual, but they had, like, it was so intense. They had to, harness and pulley themselves up, and they had a bathroom up above the stage, like one of those like camping bathrooms.
Like
a tent around it because they're like up there for so long.
Jesus.
Yeah. Intense. It was a sweet show. I'm just a little musically I'm a little bit more into Fantagram
for sure.
That's why I was there. But yeah, awesome. So Big Grams, check that out. What was the other a question I'm trying to ask on this podcast is only my second episode, but I think one that's, I think it's a nice opportunity to thank people. Who would you like to publicly thank?
My parents.
Yeah.
Hands down. No people have made more sacrifice in my name than they have. My friends, Kyle, who is the one jabbing that hot poker in my back and saying, go to LA, come to LA. It's time. You got, what are you waiting for? Mm-hmm. You did what you tried to do. Now get back here.
Yeah.
So that, that guy is Kyle Duncan Graham is the best and the definition of a great friend, as is, Alex Citroni in Austin.
Okay.
He's always been there for me. Great guy. And, you know, I mean, that's a heavy, heavy question. I didn't know I was going to get that question.
I know. I should really prep people for that.
Because
people get anxious about leaving people out. And, you
well,
know,
I don't feel anxious about that. It's just such a question that makes you examine your friendships and what these people mean to you. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm just thinking now like 1, 2, 3 people. And like, there's no time to, I mean, my life is filled with gratitude, right?
Right.
Because everybody has meaning mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. there's so many cool people. And I guess in memoriam, I would thank my grandparents too. Mm. My maternal grandparents were very big in my life and supportive and loved that I would be the type of kid to act out, you know, and like very, very young doing impressions of impressions I saw on Saturday Night Live, you know, and supporting that and playing with that. So I would say for that, mostly family, but my good friends are my family.
Right.
Yeah.
Awesome. And then, last question, where can people find you? How do they keep up with you?
You can find me in Los Angeles now. You can find me on Twitter at Dane Carrigan. So that's basically adding an E to my name.
Okay. Okay, spell it out for people.
DaneKerrigane.
Okay.
Old nickname, but still good Twitter handle.
That's good.
Yeah, you search me on Twitter, you'll find me. I guess Dan Carrigan Comedy on Facebook.
Okay.
Quicksand Rides on Instagram.
Nice. All right. I'll link to all those in my show notes.
Cool.
So people will find you. Dan, thanks so much for coming on. You took a chance because, like I said, this is a pretty new podcast, but I do have a fairly attentive group of people. And thank you to everybody who's listening. I'm actually gesturing toward the mic right now, which is maybe kind of odd because nobody can see it. But
no, it's symbolic. It represents the people we can reach.
Exactly. So thanks for coming on the show. Come back around. Let me know when you're in the Bay Area.
For sure.
Likewise, I'll tell you when I'm down in
LA ways.
Down in LA.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
It's cool.
Awesome.
All right.
So again, a big thanks to Dan for coming on the show. A big thank you to you for listening. Check out the show notes at mattloganmusic.com. Here is Solar Street Cred featuring Anyan Lee, a nurse and musician I met while working as a music therapist at the Children's Hospital across the street from where I live. So here she is, and enjoy. Have a fabulous week. I'm like Saturn.